Is from Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 1 through 18. So I invite you all to turn to that in your Bibles. All is vanity. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, "See, this is new"? It has been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things, yet to be among those who come after. The vanity of wisdom. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of men to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge, and I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this is also but a striving after wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow.
All right. Well, welcome to Church at Five. Lindsay, thank you for the text reading today. I don't know what you brought in with you today, but how many of you, as you were listening to that text reading, were like, I should have stayed home today. I was hoping to be encouraged when I came to church. And here we are. This is not the text I was hoping for. Well, good news, bad news. We're beginning a new series. Oh, man, there it is. And my voice is also not cooperating with me. Hopefully it gets us through. We're beginning a new series. We're going to go all the way through the book of Ecclesiastes. And how many of you have read through that book at least once in your life? Maybe when you were forced to in a reading plan. Some of you maybe really love that book. So let me just start by answering. Let's hope that crack just stays with us. That'll keep the mood a bit lighter as we go through this heavy text today. The first question is, why Ecclesiastes? Why would we go through this book? Why this text? Well, to be honest, I'm one of those stranger ones that it's actually one of my favorite books. Some of you might be like, oh, that explains a lot why this pastor is so strange. I really enjoy reading Ecclesiastes, and it goes all the way back to even when I was a teenager. It's one of my the books that I read more than a few times. But that's not the only reason that I've decided to go through this book with you guys. I want to give you just three things that I believe this book will teach us by the end of this series if you stick with me through it. The first one is going to be pretty obvious, and that is it's going to teach us about the absolute circular futility and despair of the state of man under the sun. That one you could already maybe get a feel for in our first chapter today. The second, though, is maybe overlooked sometimes, but hopefully if you've read through this book, you did notice that this book is going to teach us about the gift of God to experience real, genuine joy amidst the futility, amidst the vanity, amidst the uncertainty of life under the sun. And the third thing that I think it's going to teach us that I think we most likely are going to easily overlook when we read through Ecclesiastes, it's not going to be our maybe go-to for this subject, but it's going to help establish a platform in how we present the gospel, how we become evangelistic in our lives. You think, well, that seems a bit counterintuitive, but I do believe that it helps us to present to those who are lost, who are in the futility, in the despair of the state of man under the sun. And it helps us to know what that state is, to understand where we are in our position in the cosmic kind of realm of things when we're presenting, when we're trying to reach people with the hope of something greater, something better. So those are three things I hope that we will be able to take with us as we go through this series. Oh, good times. So, what is Ecclesiastes about? If you haven't read it, or even if you had, maybe you're like, I really don't know what I just read. This book is really, in a nutshell, a search for the meaning of life. And it's really asking the question, does our life even have meaning? Does it have meaning? Is there a point? Is there a purpose to things? The whole book is going to be a philosophical argument, and it is designed to be thought-provoking. It's going to make you think. It's designed to be a little antagonizing. It's going to make you a little uncomfortable, make you think about things that you don't like to think about. And it does this in a way that presents insights and wisdom from a man who has spent his entire life really going through life with his eyes open, right? Making observations through his experiences about the things that he just noticed to be true from his wisdom, as he applied wisdom to his life and observed the things that were happening around him. And then he's going to give us this book, which is this conclusion, his conclusions, to understand the meaning, the purpose of all the things that he observed. And I think, some of you are maybe past that point, or maybe you're just entering that point. We all, I think, at some point come to a place in our life where we want to ask, what's the point? Why? What am I doing? Why should I study? Why should I do this? Why should I kind of go through this or do that or not this or not that? What's the point of it all? I remember having a lot of deep arguments with my mom about what's the point of making your bed if you're just going to have to make it again the next day? It seems futile. And that's when I started to really get into Ecclesiastes and try to build an argument there. She was not impressed. Have you ever pondered the questions to the meaning of life? Or maybe have you ever looked at your life and think, maybe am I valuing the wrong things? Because I don't seem to be getting any life out of these things that I find value in. Well, I believe this book is going to help us in all of these areas, and ultimately it's even going to encourage us, believe it or not. Ecclesiastes is certainly a unique book. And so here in this first sermon, I really want to just help prepare us for this series. We will look at the text today a bit, but we're going to overlap that a little bit into next week. So I think we need to understand some things about this book. This book is very unique. Some even argue that it shouldn't be in the Bible. I would strongly disagree. I think it's there for a reason. God knows what he's doing. If it wasn't supposed to be there, it wouldn't be there. It's there for a reason, but it is unique from many other books of the Bible, especially in how we learn about God from this approach. I found this quote in a book that I've been reading, and I thought, rather than paraphrase it, I'll just read it for you, and it's actually overlapping with a quote from John Calvin, and it talks about this uniqueness that we see here, and let me just read this to help you too as we approach this book. So we discover wisdom and life by means of double knowledge. That double knowledge comes from John Calvin, which is to say the knowledge of God and of ourselves. If we want to know God, we must learn moment by moment to furnish our mind with the contemplation of God. All of the books of the Bible, in one way or another, invite us to this sense of double knowledge. Some books tend to put God more at the center stage so that we learn about God by contemplating him directly. But but one of the ways we learn to be led by the Lord and to know him more intimately
is by making us pay attention to ourselves, God revealing himself through the recovery of humanity. And this is what we see in this book. It doesn't seem to be pointing us directly at God. We're not just focusing on God's character. And, you know, if you just read through Philippians and then you jump over here, you're going to be like, yeesh, like what a difference in how, and the approach, right, where it's a lot of the New Testament is very God-centered. It's going to be focusing more on what God's done for us and how we approach that. Here we're seeing a lot. We're starting from our perspective, but this perspective helps us to better understand ourselves, to understand the state of things, to discover our humanity and how it is recovered. And in turn, this will then better help us to understand our relation to our Creator. So it's a good thing. It's a good approach. Let me drink some of my tea here. Did not bring enough tea. All right. So as we get into it, let me just quickly consider the title and the author. If you didn't know, Ecclesiastes, it's basically an English transliteration from the Greek of the title that's given in verse 1. Verse 1 says, the words of the preacher, or some translations, teacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Ecclesiastes is basically comes from a Greek word that means the assembling that is then addressed by somebody. Most translations in other languages just call it preacher or teacher or some form of that. I don't know why in English we decided to go with Ecclesiastes, but there we did. But it's basically the same idea. This comes from this title of basically a preacher or a teacher who is addressing a gathering of people. And here in verse 1, I think we also see a clear evidence that Solomon is in fact this preacher. Son of David, king in Jerusalem. Later, he's referred to as the wisest of kings. All of these fit the description of Solomon, plus the experiences this preacher speaks of, especially what we'll look at in chapter 2. He's going to talk a lot about things that his pursuits and things that he basically tried to find pleasure in and tried to find meaning in line up perfectly with Solomon's life in other accounts. And maybe we'll look a little bit at that when we get through it. But though officially the book is anonymous, and there's always debate on these things, I would say for all intents and purposes, I see no reason to doubt that Solomon is the author. And I think that's important in how we approach this. And certainly, even if the writings, maybe that was put together later, and some see the beginning and the end as maybe being an author, and then the middle is the writings of Solomon, that could be, although Paul also talks about himself in the third person, so maybe he's just doing that as well. Either way, it's definitely the writings are rooted in his wisdom and his experiences. And Solomon, we know, was a wise man. And we can look at how he even uses his sin and how he, even when he was walking away from God, that he still was able to learn through those experiences. And so hopefully we can learn from his experiences that we don't have to learn them the hard way as he did. Now, one other thing before we get into this text, as before we get into the book, and if you, I would encourage you to go through and read it maybe over the next weeks one or two times so that we can always be keeping in mind the whole book as we look at each section. As we look at Ecclesiastes with all of its really encouraging and uplifting moments and texts and sayings, how we read this book matters. How we read this book matters. So first, let me just point out that as you read it, you'll see that there are two reoccurring phrases. There's maybe three if you want to count meaningless or vanity, but two that I would say we need to understand, and that is under the sun, and the gift of God. And these are going to be kind of, they go all the way through the text, and they kind of play off of each other. And we need to understand both of those phrases. So under the sun, this phrase is mentioned about 25 times in the book. And it's not talking about, hey, I was laying out on the beach under the sun when I thought of this. It's not describing this state. Anytime we see this phrase used, we need to understand what he's saying. It is to demonstrate a universal human perspective. A universal human perspective. It is not just for the people of Israel. And maybe that's why he doesn't give his name specifically, I don't know. But it's not just for the people of Israel. It's not for any particular nation or any particular geographical location or any particular religious perspective. When he talks about the things that are happening under the sun, he's talking about a universal understanding of the state of man. every time we see this phrase under the sun, it is specifically referring to just how things are objective reality, right? How things are down here where we are, from man's perspective. This is where we live. We live still under the sun. The cool thing is that we are under the sun, believer, non-believer, all nations, we all live, and that's from that perspective. But the hope of this book is found when we also remember that as children of the Creator, we live under the one who is above the sun, who has the better perspective, who knows how everything will work out. And he is a God who works all things out together for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purpose. And I can know that, and I can find peace in that and rest in that, even though here from my perspective, under the sun, I can't always see the why. I can't always see the means. I can't always see the purpose. And that's the point. And that's the difference between under the sun and then the other phrase, this is the gift of God. This is the gift of God, which is a phrase we'll also see all throughout the book. Among the vanity of life, the meaninglessness that we can experience in this life, the despair we can fall into, the preacher also discovers our greatest hope is to gain the gift of God, to gain the gift of God. This is every good thing that we experience. Every good moment, he talks about the littlest things too. He talks about eating. He talks about enjoying a good day's work. This is a gift of God from the fleeting joy of watching a sunset. Or for me, I always think of these moments I have with my kids right now while they're still young and I'm still their hero. I enjoy those moments very much. To good food, good company, a good work day, down to our salvation itself, as we know from the New Testament, right? This is a gift of the Lord. Our salvation comes from the Lord. So this is our hope. And let me also put before you, as you are about to maybe read through this book this week, that we can read through this book wrongly. We can read through this book wrongly, having a wrong approach. This book has some startling, worldview-shaking claims and perspectives. I know a lot of Christians come to it. A lot of preachers try to kind of shape it in, I think, a negative way or an inappropriate way. Because I don't like it. I don't like what it's saying here. It makes me uncomfortable. It's going to talk about the futility of life under the sun, vanity, meaningless. And so I think there are two ways of reading this as Christians. There are two ways of reading this as Christians that we should try to avoid as we approach the text. The first is to embrace life's futility, to become hyper aware of the vanity of life and to kind of use it as an excuse to fall into despair. And we can read through a lot of philosophers throughout history, especially maybe in the 20th century, that have done this. They've embraced this, over-embraced it, over-indulged in it even. I think of myself as a teen, being an angsty teen. You know, to read this with woe is me kind of mentality. You know, nothing really matters. What's the point? I shouldn't have to make my bed. There's no point to anything. Everything is meaningless. These are the people who maybe love this book too much for the wrong reasons. You know, I think of Hemingway, who has a quote from Ecclesiastes at the beginning of one of his books, who embraced the vanity of life to its fullest and came to the ultimate conclusion. And this is a non-believer's approach to the reality that I need to just take my own life. It's the only thing that makes sense. This is the pessimist, the nihilist. And some people, and even Christians, read through Ecclesiastes with a fatalist kind of mentality. It can lead to egotism, hedonism, even, I would say, moralism in an inappropriate way if we approach this and approach the despair of this book with an overindulgence. And it can lead to a false view of Ecclesiastes. So we don't want to come with that approach. On the other side, the second perspective to avoid is denial, right? To just deny it. Right? And this is something I often see when Ecclesiastes is preached. They just want to always get through it or, you know, get to some kind of greater point without really understanding what the preacher is trying to teach us. To pretend that life is just never futile, to make excuses for the way things are, and to ignorantly and somewhat foolishly just pretend like everything's just okay. Or it doesn't mean what it says there. And this leads to kind of a type of a false sense of piety. You know, and it's almost done in this like in this self-righteousness, trying to just explain away the heavy statements that are made throughout this book, which is, in fact, to miss the point of the argument that he's trying to build for us. There is vanity in life. There is futility, uncertainty to our life under the sun. And this is true of all people, whether you're a believer or not. All people are going to experience this. Rather, we should read Ecclesiastes as a peering behind the curtain, looking at the despairing nature of reality and an almost comic reality of life under the sun. It's not describing anything that we don't know to be true if we're paying attention. We just don't like to think about it. But if we take an almost comedic approach, it sheds a different light on this text. And I don't mean that like, ha-ha, funny. Not that we should make light of these things, but acknowledge their reality. What does it benefit us if we just run from these thoughts that we just want to avoid, that this book is going to make us think about? Or, on the other side, to break our heads against the wall, trying to analyze them with our philosophy and unpack everything. As it says in Ecclesiastes, of the filling of books, there is no end. You're not going to have all the answers to why. Why did that happen? Why did God let this happen? Why did this happen? Why does it go this way? Why do we see life this way? Why is there repetition the way that it is in life? Why is that? We don't always have the answers, and we never will have all the answers on this side of the sun, under the sun. I encourage you to read through this book, but make sure you read it with the right mentality. Not indulging yourself in the misery of it all, that some seem to do, nor simply dismissing every argument that the preacher is trying to make because you don't want to think about it. As you read it, as you read through Ecclesiastes, and I encourage you again to read through it, always keep in mind that he's building an argument. He's building an argument. You can't just, if you read just this part and then this part and jumped around, you'd be like, this guy's nuts, man. He doesn't know what he wants from life. He's all over the place. But if you read it from beginning to end, you see that he's building an argument. He's going somewhere, and you have to understand each section. We must look at each section and how each argument prepares us for the next. And this means walking through some of the dark observations of this book. But it also means noticing some of the encouraging truths. Ultimately, we will reach the conclusion of the book. Spoiler alert. He calls us to live in righteousness because out of everything he's observed, this is the best way to go, to live to the glory of God as one who will give an account. The end of the matter, as it says in the book, end of the book, fear God and keep his commands, keep his commandments. And all throughout the book, we see these encouraging truths, like the great gift of God that allows us to experience this life with joy and with freedom, real freedom. This book depicts an understanding of joy and freedom that I think is very unique, that we miss if we're not paying attention. This is a gift for the believer, though. This is a gift for the believer. And it is a true experience of joy, a joy that comes not just when things are good, but in all circumstances. But we cannot truly enjoy that freedom. We can't understand and enjoy these conclusions that he gives us without going through the valley of the philosophical arguments that he's making and the application of those arguments in real life situations. And that's what I want to put to you as we get into Ecclesiastes. Now that you've had some kind of foundation, hopefully you understood everything I said in my crackling voice. Now let's get into some of the text today. As we begin, we think about this word Ecclesiastes, an assembly, a gathering of people. We can imagine this elderly man with his wise words who comes to address a crowd. He's gained so much experience, observed so many things in his life. He's filled with knowledge and wisdom, and he stands before the hearers who are eager to hear his conclusion. In all of your studies, all of your searches, all the applications of wisdom, what can you teach us? And he begins, vanity of vanities, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Can imagine some confused looks. I think I signed up for the wrong lecture. This brings us then to another important thing we need to understand as we approach the book of Ecclesiastes, and that is this word, vanity. If you have the NIV and some other English translations, it says meaningless. The word is hevel. The Hebrew word is hevel, and it literally means vapor or smoke, and it's used here as a metaphor. So we have to understand that this is a metaphor and what that means for us as we look through it. It's 38 times this word is used throughout the book, and it's what sets the stage. It's his introduction. You know, it's what sets the stage for the whole book. This word is meant to place an image in our mind. That's what a metaphor is meant to do. We need to picture something. It's hard to really, I think, vanity is a better translation than meaningless. I think meaningless is not a great word because it isn't what he's saying. He's not saying it's meaningless. He's trying to put a picture, an image in our head when considering the pursuits of our life, when we observe the things of this world, they amount to what is like vapor or smoke. Life under the sun is fleeting, temporary. Nothing really lasts like vapor. It's there and then pff, it's gone. This is the image we see as in some of the applications. And to try and hold on to it is like chasing after the wind. It's like grabbing at smoke. Good luck with that. Not going to go well. And like vapor, it's often undefined. If you saw just some smoke coming up, it's like, well, define the shape of that. It'd be difficult to do. It's hard to define it. It's an enigma. It's paradoxical. It's random. It's unpredictable. This is the state of life. So it isn't saying it's meaningless. I think vanity is a little bit better, but we need to have this image in our mind, this metaphor of this smoke, this thing that's hard to define. It's paradoxical. It's temporary. It's fleeting. And this is what sets the stage for all the different elements that he applies this to in life. The preacher is going to observe or has observed, experienced, and then reported on or gave his conclusion. So the preacher here begins, get a little bit into the text today, and we'll overlap it again with next week. So the preacher begins with the futility of the cycles of life and nature. Verse 4 again, he says, a generation goes, and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. And this is just, again, we know some people like to point that out. Oh, that's contradicting. You know, in other passages, it talks about how the world will come to an end. And what is that? And this is why we shouldn't read this. And what is he saying, though? What is he talking about? He's talking about from our perspective. From our perspective, under the sun, this is what we see. We don't see the end. We can't perceive the end. We can only see that things just go on and on. We can look back and think of all the generations that came before us. We can imagine all the generations that come after us, and it just feels like who are we? We're just this little dot amongst many generations. We're just this little speck, this little point in history, and things, the earth is going to keep going. I could die tonight. Tomorrow, the sun will still rise. Tomorrow, the days will continue. Generations will still come and go. That's the point. It's looking at life from our perspective under the sun. Verse 5, he goes right there. The sun rises, and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. This is an interesting one because, you know, we know now that the sun doesn't rise, so why do we call it sunrise still and not earth turn? Because it sounds weird. No. Because, again, it just points out our perspective. We perceive life from our perspective, from where we're standing. We don't see the earth turning. It's amazing to think how fast we're moving through space right now, and that we have no perception of it. We look at the sun rise and we see it come up. We see it go down. We don't sense the earth turning. So it's talking about the futility of our perspective. There is a greater reality, and that's what we're going to see when we look at the gifts of God, and also when we think about the New Testament and our perceptions of things in eternal perspective. But it begins here with our perspective, how we see things. It reminds us that from our perspective here under the sun, there's the futility of the day after day after day. It goes on and on and on. He uses other examples of nature. He talks about the wind in verse 6. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. This is describing the jet stream in a lot of ways, I would say, which is kind of interesting that they kind of get that he would be able to observe that there is a certain sense of repetition. Because if you go outside, you don't really sense that. It just feels chaotic. It feels like there's no purpose. And yet he sees that, no, it's just everything's just kind of continuing. I remember I loved watching the weather with my dad when I was a kid on the news, back when we sat down and watched the news on a TV. No one really does that anymore. Or just checks it on their phones. Well, it was a long time ago. And I remember, you know, you hear about the jet stream was always the big thing in the weather. You know, oh, the jet stream's moving down. But it's like, after a while, it's like, well, it doesn't really do anything new. It goes down and it goes up and it goes down again and it goes up again. But it just keeps going round and round and round. Shows us that nothing really changes. There's nothing really new from our perspective. It's endless repetition in nature. Even the wind that, again, seems chaotic, seems random, still has some kind of endless cycle. This is our perspective from life under the sun. He even uses water. Verse 7, all streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. You can imagine that from his perspective at that time, that would have been like, this is strange. I see rivers just dumping in there, but the water level never goes up to the place where the streams flow. They return to the place where they come from. And we know you learn about this as you're in like first year in grade school. It's the water system, right? Water evaporates, goes, rains, endless repetition. This is what we see from our perspective. It's kind of amazing that he was able to observe this back then. And it can feel like there's just no beginning, no end. Everything just goes on and on. It makes you feel very small. Verse 8, this is kind of his conclusion here from looking at nature. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. It's like the vanity of just the natural world and the pursuit of understanding it. His conclusion is that after all of his observations of nature, is that the eye is never really satisfied. Right? You keep looking and you see the repetitions, but there's always also more to know, more to discover. And then that leads to more things, and you find new cycles, and then there's just it just also never ends in itself. The pursuit of knowing is also never ending and can feel like vanity, like grasping at smoke. It's tiresome, can make a man weary to see the endlessness of nature. And again, science is, I would say, obviously a noble pursuit. It's a good thing to seek to understand these things, and I would say we should. But in themselves, we can find no true end or no true satisfaction. It all becomes vanity, like a vapor, like chasing after the wind. You can grasp at it, but you're never going to truly hold it in your hands. There's always going to be more to know, more cycles to discover, and then that leads to more things. And I would say the weariness there points out that if this is your purpose, if this is your only purpose to know everything, you're going to find yourself weary. You're going to find yourself feeling a little empty. You're going to find yourself disappointed. And here he goes a bit broader in verse 9 and 10. He says, what has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has been already in the ages before us. Now, in one sense, we can say, wait a minute, okay, but, you know, I mean, some things are new, right? I mean, we've got electricity, we've got, you know, technology, and we've got, you know, transportation. You know, we're living in a postmodern world, and, you know, a lot of things are new. And I'll say, okay, in one sense, you know, we can communicate with one another a lot faster, but people are really still talking about the same things. It's interesting, My wife and I, when we go into cities, we always try to find like little bookshops. They're becoming very rare. You almost never find them anymore, I feel like. And like I remember finding this old book, and it was like somebody had written like an autobiography, and I think it was from like 1540 something. And it was just some guy. He wasn't really particularly special, but he lived in Florence. And I read through this book, and I was so fascinated that it could have been talking about something that happened a week ago. You know, it was just the same pursuits, the same desires, the same ambitions, the same kind of vanity of life, the same experiences. These things haven't really changed, right? And if you're really looking, you see, well, this really isn't anything new. The means might change. Our clothes, our styles might change, and technology might change, but we remain the same. Our pursuits, our desires, our ambitions still look the same. There is nothing new under the sun. Again, from our perspective. Verse 11, there is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. How many of you can tell me some details about your great-great-grandfather? Or maybe even your great-grandfather? What he accomplished in his life? What was his passions? What did he do for a job? What was his hobbies? Interesting to think about, because that's really not that long ago. It's a sobering thought to consider from our perspective here under the sun that our names will be forgotten. Our names will be forgotten. We will be reduced at best to maybe a photo in an album, maybe a story or two. Maybe if you do something really great, you might be remembered for a little while by a few people. For the most part, we're not. Most part, everything that was is forgotten by everyone who comes after. And we know this to be true, even though we don't. That's one of those ones that we don't like to think about. Oh, I don't like that. And we can feel a certain anguish from the preacher as he considers what he's learned, as he's approaching, as he's kind of beginning to dive into his arguments, dive into this kind of this argument he's going to be building throughout this whole book. In verse 17 and 18, he says, "And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly." So he's like, I tried all the different approaches, all the approaches of life. And we'll see that starting next week in some of his approaches that he takes, especially with folly and madness. I perceive that this also is but a striving after wind. So even in these pursuits, it's like it just never ends. It's hard to see the point. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. This is why we don't like to think about these things. This is why it makes us uncomfortable. The more we know, the more we're aware of the state of things, the more we're aware of our spot in human history as this tiny blip, and the fleeting nature of our life, the futility of our pursuits, it can bring this kind of certain sense of hopelessness. But again, this book will also show us the gifts of God. And this is where I think we really begin to see the good news of this book, that we see the gifts of God, the joy we can experience amidst the reality of life under the sun. One point that he's going to make, the preacher's going to make again and again throughout this book as we prepare ourselves to get in deeper starting next week. Whether it's riches or piety or pleasures or great accomplishments or political status, whatever it is that you're seeking, whatever it is you're trying to accomplish, whatever it is you're trying to gain for yourself, all these things in themselves amount to nothing. Everything you gain will be taken away by someone else after you die. He has a whole section about that. It's really depressing. It's like you might be a righteous man and have great wealth, and then the wicked take it after you die. And what was the point? What was it all for? Everything you gain will be taken by someone else after you die. You can live a righteous life and bad things will still happen to you, and death will still come for you. And whatever you accomplish, whatever position you gain, whatever thing that you've kind of achieved in 100 years or 200 years at the most, it's unlikely that anyone will even know who you were. You guys are like, man, please end on a cheerier note than this. So if you find your identity in those things, if you find your identity in your job, in your money, in your position in life, and what you can do, even the good things that you can do, if that's your one thing that's like, this is who I am, and then you kind of build this idea with God, like, if I live this way, if I do this thing, then that means this and this must happen. You know, God will bless me if I'm live this way. We have all of these mentalities, and Ecclesiastes just says, nope, that's not how it always works. Life isn't like that. It's like vapor. It's like smoke. It's not predictable. It's unpredictable. It's perplexing. It's difficult to understand. It's hard to grasp. It's not always fair. And it's fleeting. It will pass away. On the one hand, if we listen to the teachings of this book, we will learn to enjoy the good things that we have in the moments we are given them. Even though we live in this fleeting, vain, inconsistent, perplexing world. And this joy does not come from denying the reality of life under the sun, as some like to think it does. It doesn't come from denying the reality of life under the sun, but through embracing it. Through embracing it. That's what Ecclesiastes is going to teach us. So as we close today, and let me just say, if you think this was rough, hold on to your hats, because there's a lot more we're going to be getting into in this book. Some even more cheery, encouraging things he likes to share with us. He has a whole section devoted to death, so get ready for that one. But I want to leave you with this. This idea of embracing something. Not hiding from it, not running from it, but embracing it. You can think about that this week as we look through this kind of repetitions that we saw in the text. With his observations of nature and generations passing, and the sun rising. This is describing the state of things under the sun, and if you look around, we can't disagree. That is how things are. The world is filled with endless repetitions, and I would encourage you to think about that this week, because hopefully it will prepare you to say, well, how do I find joy in this? How do I find joy in this? Because he's going to talk about this, and he's going to talk about this gift of God that we can find joy even in these repetitions. And we think about how many times have you ridden the tram in the exact same way to work or to class? How many times did you do that same run? How many times were you maybe stuck at the same light in traffic? How many hours of your life have added up to those little moments? How many times have you maybe heard the same introduction at a lecture? Or how many times have I changed poopy diapers? I don't even want to know. There's repetition. But we can be aware of it and then learn how to find joy even in that repetition. But not only is it filled with repetition, not only is life filled with these repetitions, it's filled with paradoxes. That good things happen to bad people and bad things happen to good people. And it's hard to wrap our brain around that. My sister-in-law works here in Freiburg at the Children's Cancer Ward. Man, I can tell you there's been many times where she's just come to my wife and just bawling. Like, man, this is hard to see. Why is this happening? Why a newborn baby with cancer? That's perplexing. That's hard to wrap our brain around. As it says in our text today, it is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. This is the state of things. It's the way of the world under the sun. But here's the thing. The difference between the perspective that we have here from under the sun and the believer is found in those gifts of God. I don't always know why things happen the way they do. Because I'm also under the sun. But I can trust that God is working all things together for good. I don't always understand from down here under the sun, but I trust in Him who is above the sun. From down here under the sun, we can only see the endless repetition, how things just continue, and it can make us feel so small. We're just this little blip in human history. And it can feel like things will just go on forever. But I also know that God is the one who said, in the beginning. It is He who started everything into motion, and it is He who is going to finish everything. He will bring all things into restoration according to His goodwill and His purpose. So we only see the repetition, but God sees a collection. He sees the beginning and the end, and He is the Alpha and the Omega. This book is going to show us the reality of our life under the sun. Let us not run from it or hide from it or try to excuse it away, but embrace it with its misery and sometimes despair, so that we can also fully embrace the good news of the gospel, that we can fully understand the good gifts that God has given us amidst our place under the sun, amidst this world that sometimes doesn't make sense to us, amidst this world that sometimes feels like it's just unending repetitions. From our salvation through Christ as a good gift of the Lord, all the way down to enjoying a cheeseburger and even finding peace amidst troubled times in our life. This is what this book will teach us if we want to learn it. Let me invite the band to come up as we close in prayer. Lord, we thank You for the perplexing and difficult books like this that hopefully rock us and shake us a little bit in a way that helps us to cling to You, in a way that helps us to see Your greater purpose, Your greater gifts, even though we don't always understand, even though life is confusing, even though we feel small and insignificant sometimes, and it can make us feel hopeless, it can make us feel insignificant. But we know, Lord, that You also see us. And those of us here today who are believers, those of us here today who call on the name of the Lord, who have been called by name by You, the Good Shepherd, that we can have peace and find joy in the good gifts of You, even amidst our place under the sun. Please teach us that as we go through this book over the next few weeks and months. In Jesus' name, amen.